Welcome to MTC Talks. I'm Sarah Corridan, and today we're talking to award-winning composer and sound designer Russell Goldsmith. Russell tells us about his latest production, John, and some of the secrets behind capturing those weird and wonderful sounds. Thanks for joining us, Russell.
You are welcome.
I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your history with the Melbourne Theatre Company. Can you tell us about the very first production that you did?
I did a production here called The Swimming Club, which I think would have been 2009. It was early 2010 because I remember the director, Kate Cherry, and Hanny Rayson had a little Christmas party at their place to meet and greet all of the cast and crew together. And it was great. It was the first time I'd worked in the Sumner in any capacity. I'd been and seen a bunch of shows in there, but it hadn't been open very long by then. And it was a really interesting experience. So part of it was in contemporary Australia, and part of the other half of the show was set in Lesvos in Greece. It was a group of friends trying to relive their early 80s experiences on a Greek island and what has happened to them since then. So I had great fun as the composer of the show, re-rendering songs from 1983 as kind of Greek bouzouki songs.
When did you first know that you wanted to work with the medium of sound?
It's funny, I was thinking this on the walk over here when I first started getting interested in sound for live performance. I know for a fact that I used to record insects and my dog and things out in the backyard of my house on a little portable tape deck that my parents got me. Wow. And make my own little radio programs, tape things off.
How
the radio.
Old?
Seven or eight probably. And so I like to look back on that and think, oh yes, I've always had an interest in sound. But when I was in high school, a whole bunch of my friends wanted to get involved in the theatre productions at school. And some of them were performers, some of them musicians, some of them were backstage people. And so there were probably 10 or 12 of us that all just kind of volunteered to do stuff. And I just got dumped behind a sound console. And so...
How interesting.
Yeah, it was just an accident.
And are those friends still working in theatre?
No. No, some of them didn't work in theatre at that time. They were looking for somewhere to hide so they didn't have to go to PE.
Yeah.
But I just stayed.
You did a fabulous job with John, which we saw last night. It was mesmerising. A play written by Annie Baker, set in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, at a bed and breakfast. That may or may not be haunted. We still don't know.
We still don't know.
But sound plays a really big role in this play. Bit of a fifth character, you could say.
Yeah. Well, I like to think the piano is the fifth character and the rest of the sound design is the sixth character.
A lot of personality in that piano.
Yeah, it's great.
But the soundscape almost tricks the audience at times. It makes them question whether they are hearing noise or not. So how did you approach this soundscape?
For me, reading the script, and I've done an Annie Baker show before. I did The Flick, which has just opened in Queensland at Queensland Theatre. And so I was familiar with her work, familiar with the stillness that's present in all of her work. And in the discussions I had with Sarah, the director of John, and with Elizabeth, the designer, and Richard, the lighting designer, we were all kind of united in this belief that what we really needed to do was make those still moments okay, that the moments of emptiness in the house were as interesting as the most fast-paced, intense dialogue. We started with the kind of spooky ghost moments in the show and tried to decide how heavy-handed or otherwise they should be, and it was always our intention to create a sensation in the audience that they had to lean into those moments to really kind of crane their neck and tweak their ear and see if they can establish whether they're hearing something or not. And that that audio illusion is really wonderful to play with. And, you know, it's just bald-faced manipulation of an audience, just trying to force them to engage with something, drag them into the show and make them question their own senses. And that's fun. That's
absolutely. Really fun. And I mean, sound is one of the components of theatre that isn't given much direction from, or in many cases, no direction from the playwright. So it's kind of like a blank canvas for you, which must be fun.
Yeah, it often is. This piece, to Annie's credit, she was sometimes really specific about what those sounds were, and she's even woven into the text itself descriptions that the characters give of what they're hearing. And so Genevieve says it's kind of a whistling, a rustling, a beating of wings. And you look at it and you go, well, they're three different things. Is she hearing some of this in her head and some of this in the house? Is she hearing none of this in the house? And should the audience's experience mirror her experience, or should the audience's experience be unique to them and bring another flavour entirely? And so we kept it deliberately ambiguous. But as a kind of side note, the sounds that are present in that kind of ghostly moment are all made up of a little toy piano accordion that I have with the reeds disabled. So it's the kind of wheezing bellows of a piano accordion and the clicking sound it makes as it goes backwards and forwards as the kind of paper accordion rests and stretches and contracts. Just because I liked the sound, and it was an organic sound in a way. It spoke to a kind of movement, a rushing of air, breathing. So it evoked some of the things that Annie was trying to evoke, but it was also something tangible. It wasn't a ghost. It wasn't a monster. It wasn't, you know, it was an instrument.
Well, I was going to ask how closely you collaborate with your creative team, and it sounds very close. You've worked with Sarah and Richard before, I believe.
I've never worked with Sarah before. I've worked with Richard Varbray, the lighting designer, many times, and we have, I was going to say a shorthand, but that would be disingenuous. We just talk incessantly to each other. We don't have, it's long form arguments about how things should be, but those collaborations with lighting designers in particular are super important to me, because I think in moments, if those two departments are doing different things or heading off in different directions, it makes both of those departments seem inferior in a way. So my work is always more powerful with the cooperation of a lighting designer and ensuring that we're making the same show.
It must be nice to have those relationships in the industry when it, you know, can be a solitary experience.
Yeah, I mean, I spend a huge amount of my time by myself in my studio staring at a computer screen surrounded by things that make funny noises. And so I divide my time kind of equally between that solitary time and the time where I'm in a rehearsal room or in a production meeting or collaborating with a bunch of people, interrogating them for their ideas. And, you know, the set design is always incredibly influencing for me. Mm-hmm. I'm always interested in what I can extract from that, just looking at it as a drawing or looking at the model. I always learn a lot about how the show might feel, what I can contribute. Again, what's missing, there are objects in there that I can be inspired by. This production has a piano, so that piano instantly set me off on a particular path. There's this set, and part of it is Annie's writing and part of it is Elizabeth's design, is full of things that make noise. And so for me, it was about working out how many of those things I wanted to play with and how many of them just sit inert and do nothing.
Can you give me some examples of props or elements in the set of John that make noise?
So I don't know if you noticed the clock that was sitting in the corner there is not a constant kind of presence through the show, but it ebbs and flows, and there are times where it returns and it's quite present, and there are times where it kind of recedes and is just sitting there. And that's part of honouring the ghost story, where things in the house are strange and we've got permission to do that because of where Annie's taken the writing. But also because those things are so much more potent when they start or stop or your attention's drawn to it. As soon as it's constant, we as human beings have this remarkable ability to tune them out.
Yeah. Well, the clock is so important in the play because it indicates passage of time, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's right. Well, and,
it's scene transition.
It's, yes, it's part of Myrtis's kind of control of the world that she lives in is that she's manipulating time. And so it's a heartbeat. You know, it's a heartbeat that keeps the show going. And when it stops, there's this eeriness of why it's my heart stopped.
How thoroughly do you look at the social and political constructs of a script? So in John, for example, do you really read into the history of a setting, or do you think about what a fraying romantic relationship could sound like?
What an incisive question. That's great. I am more interested in the more literal context of the piece, because that's what's going to inspire me initially. I think the emotional undercurrent of the work is always something that I have to follow as a sound designer. I have to recognise what the emotional ebb and flow within the work is, and sometimes work in opposition to that, but most of the time work in harmony with how the piece is evolving. But for me, the setting of this piece in particular in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the Civil War background, all of that stuff was interesting and kind of fertile material to start with, but it didn't lead me anywhere. I wasn't really interested in making the music for this work kind of fife and drum Civil War era music. It didn't really seem like that's what this work was. It was so strongly about the dissolving of this relationship and the curiosity of the other characters that inhabit this world, that the Gettysburg thing was a background rather than a foreground thing. It was a lost place where all of these souls have gone and are having this experience together. But I never really looked into why Annie Baker set the piece in Gettysburg, whether there was any wider resonance, whether that was important to her, or if it was just a place full of dead things.
You put a short recording on Twitter last week of a miniature train going around its tracks, and the caption said, "For Melbourne Theatre Company's upcoming production of John, the weird things I get to do for art." So my question for you, Russell, is what are some of the other weird things you've done for art?
Well, I've found myself up to my waist in seawater trying to record waves crashing on Cape Shank Beach for this company, in fact. There was a show that I did here that was set in the US, in a particular part of the US where there's no sand on the beach. The beaches are all kind of stone beaches. And there is a beach in Victoria, in Cape Shank, that is similar to that. And without getting the MTC to fly me to America to record the real thing, I went down to Cape Shank and recorded the stones clanging together as the water rushes through them. So as the waves wash in, the stones are all kind of lifted up and separated, and as the water rushes back out again, they all kind of clang down. And that was just set in the background. It was almost inaudible in the show. But for me, there was a satisfying part of knowing that I wasn't just using a stock sound effect. But yes, all sorts of crazy places I've recorded things. And to drag this back to John, the Christmas tree that comes on and off throughout the show, every time it extinguishes, it's got this little zappy kind of thing that happens. That's a recording I did years and years ago of an insect zapper, a bug zapper, with bugs flying into it. And it just kind of worked. I tried a whole host of other things, electronic noises and electricity arcing, and it was all too aggressive.
The pianola, or the piano,
yep,
with a mind of its own in John.
Yep.
Can you please tell me the story?
Of course. I'm glad you referred to it as a pianola, because that's what it's supposed to look like. But it's not actually a pianola. It's something that Yamaha make called a Disclavia, which is a piano that is driven by MIDI. And MIDI is a digital audio protocol that was developed in the 80s by the Japanese. And it's basically a set of instructions to do something, MIDI. And so this particular piano that is used in John receives instructions from our show computer. And essentially the instructions are what note to play and how hard. And a long string of those instructions essentially make a composition. And so we're firing that piano via MIDI. I couldn't put my finger on how old the piano is, but it's probably only 10 years old. It's come from the Sydney Theatre Company who own it. And it's been scenically treated by the scenic workshop people at the Melbourne Theatre Company and the props department at the Melbourne Theatre Company to look like an old-fashioned pianola. So they removed the original lid from the piano and extended it by about 20 centimetres so that they could fit a piano scroll mechanism in the front of it. They added a candelabra and then they've treated it and painted it so that it looks old and consistent with the rest of the piano, but on the inside it's shiny black new piano, but on the outside it's this broken down old brown, you know, century old machine. And magically we can have it play itself, and the piano roll spins, but it doesn't do anything. The instructions are coming from the show computer to play the two tunes that are in the show. And that's all built into the script. That was something that Annie Baker wrote into John, that this piano magically plays itself. And when we caught that, when I first read the script, we had a series of options of how we could deal with that moment. We could just find a pianola. We could then look online and buy the piano roll for that particular tune, put it in the piano, and then cross our fingers and hope that it all just played as we wanted it to play. Or we could find a clever way to do it. But yeah, that's the magic piano that plays in the corner. And there are so many moving parts in John. There are so many things that happen, and, you know, hundreds of sound cues, hundreds of lighting cues. There are revolves. There are all sorts of other things. The one thing that, touch wood, has been rock solid is that beautiful piano, and it's been amazing. I think we all were very cynical about whether or not we could even do what we wanted to do with it, but it has been glorious.
And what kind of excites you the most about the future of technology in the world of audio? You said it's a young medium almost.
It is. It's hard to put a finger on who first did sound design for theatre, but it kind of grew out of film. In the film world, the role of the sound designer first fell to people that were editing films, because they were responsible for editing the dialogue as well as the picture. And so the first sound designers in film were often picture editors. And then sometimes those film directors would go off and work on stage in their downtime and drag their sound designer friends along to make noises for them. And that might have been in the 60s or 70s. So it's,
when did Foley come in?
Well, they've been doing that a very long time, because there wasn't a good way to lock sound to picture. So for a long time, sound was done after the fact.
Mm.
And sounds that weren't necessarily the real thing were added after the fact to replicate what things should sound like on film. But within the theatre, they were still doing kind of Foley-style effects from offstage door knocks and wind machines and all sorts of crazy rain-making things. That was all a stage manager's job, to do all of that, until the 80s.
Mm.
And then with the advent of tape recorders and a cheap medium that was relatively reliable, they started recording effects onto tapes, which the stage managers would still operate. And even, where are we now? Probably 20 years ago, they were still using reel-to-reel tape, multiple reel-to-reel tape decks in theatre to play back simple sound effects. But it wasn't really until compact disc and then the mini disc that came after that, which would have been the mid-90s, mm-hmm. probably, early to mid-90s, that you could start to create more complicated designs and layer things together. And so... the last show I did on mini disc and compact disc would have been in the mid 2000s, maybe 2005. and I had three mini disc players and three CD players and a mixing console for the stage manager, and I would kind of give them very complicated instructions about what to operate when in what sequence and how to fade up what over what period of time. And bless them, doesn't matter how competent they were, I was lucky if I got within 10% of the volume that I wanted over, you know, trying to do a 30-second audio fade whilst you're watching other things and cueing other people. It was just, it was a task that was beyond anybody.
Yeah.
And so by the mid-2000s, the greatest revolution that's come along, computerised audio playback, happened. And we were already using computers to record and edit audio, but as far as the playback side of it, using it practically in theatre, it didn't exist until the mid-2000s. And once it did, all of the world of film, all of the integrated and thoughtful and gentle and subtle or overt controlled sound that had been populating film for decades could now be integrated into theatre. And so John has 700 and something sound cues within it. Some of them are really subtle little lifts of elements, little fades up and fades down just in key moments. It's something where, you know, 30 or 40 might have been as many sound cues as I could do. It's one of those scenarios where it's a delight to sit down and try to do something and find that I can. I go to work and I go, I wonder if I can, and the answer is almost always, oh, I can. And that's great.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Well, you don't only work in theatre. You have worked across film and television and installation works. Do you have a preferred medium or does it totally depend on the project?
Is this an MTC podcast? Theatre is definitely my favourite medium then. I love theatre. I do. I mean, yes, I work across all sorts of other mediums and I keep coming back to theatre. I love sitting in the dark and making magic. And the other thing, and it seems corny, but the other thing I love is seeing the backs of 500, 600, 1,000 heads who in that moment are being held by something I've contributed to. And I don't necessarily get that in some of the other fields I work in. Some of the work I do just goes out into the world and I never have that direct feedback from the people who are consuming it. But in a theatre, I can sit up the back and I can see in that moment something that I've done or helped do engage people.
The play John, written by Annie Baker, directed by Sarah Goods, with sound design and composition from Russell Goldsmith, is playing at the Arts Centre Fairfax Studio until the 25th of March. Book online at mtc.com.au or phone the box office on 03 8688 0800. This podcast is part of the MTC Talk series. To listen to more episodes, visit mtc.com.au or search for MTC Talks in the iTunes Store or on SoundCloud.